Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, coming to you live today from Campbell Hall, campus of the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign, WILL-AM 580. It's a pleasure to be here. We have a live show for you today, a terrific show. One of our guests will be someone who's been here many times to much acclaim, Norman Solomon, the noted journalist, has a new film out on media coverage of war in Iraq and in general. It's going to be a terrific show, so please sit back, relax, and enjoy us for the next hour. But first, let's go to Media Minutes.
Any views or opinions expressed by the hosts of Media Minutes are their own and do not necessarily reflect those of this station, its management, or licensee.
Welcome to Media Minutes, a weekly review of news relating to the intersection of media and democracy. I'm John Anderson.
And I'm Kimberly Cronick.
Major phone and cable companies continue their push for statewide video franchising regulation. Moves to consolidate these negotiations at a statewide level not only diminish the power of local communities to respond to and correct service problems, but they reduce the leverage they have over phone and cable companies to support public access and other local programming channels. So far, some 15 states have approved so-called streamlined video franchise laws. Of those 15, a dozen reside in the 22-state service area of AT&T, which has been one of the most prolific lobbyists on the issue. Not all states are buckling under the political onslaught, though. At least four this year have tabled industry-sponsored bills. In New Jersey, where a statewide video franchising law went into effect last year, people who've switched from their old cable TV provider to a new service provided by Verizon are finding themselves without access to public educational and governmental access channels. Verizon has promised to provide such access as required by state law, but claims that technical issues regarding the connectivity between its fiber optic network and the cable system have delayed the carriage of PEG channels, which should be fixed by sometime this fall. This excuse does not explain, however, why this problem only seems to affect those channels devoted to community media.
Getting information out of the federal government was supposed to get easier in recent years, but new reports suggest that the opposite is the case. In late 2005, President Bush issued a directive ordering all executive agencies to clear their growing backlogs of Freedom of Information Act requests. But a study from the Coalition of Journalists for Open Government says nothing has changed. In fact, many agencies are cutting staff that deal with FOIA requests. They're also making it more expensive for journalists and ordinary citizens to file such petitions, and are blanket rejecting more FOIA requests than ever before. In addition, many agencies are in violation of a law passed 10 years ago that was designed to make government more electronically transparent. Analysis by the National Security Archive finds that only one in five federal agencies post all the records they're required to on their websites, as required by the 1997 eFOIA law. 6% are in compliance with the law's requirement to post the full guidelines for filing a successful Freedom of Information Act request. And 3/4 of all federal agencies don't even have an online FOIA submission form. The most egregious offenders can be found in the military and the Department of Homeland Security, while NASA and the Department of Education are the most eFOIA friendly.
It was less than 10 years ago that the U.S. Justice Department was hot on the heels of Microsoft, claiming the company was using its dominance in the personal computer operating system market to restrict competition around a variety of software applications. The company and government reached a settlement in the antitrust case in 2001, a part of which required Microsoft to promise not to engineer its products in such a way as to degrade the performance of third-party applications. Earlier this year, however, Google complained to federal and state justice departments that Microsoft's new Windows Vista operating system is designed in such a way as to slow down the use of Google search tools, ostensibly in an attempt to drive Windows users to Microsoft's own search products and services. But a Department of Justice memo has dismissed this concern and instead signals that the government will not intervene to set things right. The Assistant Attorney General who wrote the controversial memo used to work at a law firm which represented Microsoft in several antitrust cases, though a Justice Department spokesperson denied that he ever did legal work directly for Microsoft while in private practice. In addition, the federal government is defending Microsoft against European Union allegations that the company still leverages its operating system market power in an anti-competitive manner. The delegation overseeing this diplomatic discourse is led by a former Microsoft lobbyist who has reportedly recused himself from the discussions.
The United Surveillance of America is beginning to expand beyond its borders. although a large portion of international phone and most internet traffic is shunted through switching centers in the United States. Federal law enforcement agencies are not satisfied with the expanded access they've been granted to monitor all that traffic with tools like warrantless wiretapping and the installation of massive surveillance nodes directly into major internet backbone facilities. Now, the United States government is helping to pay for a new multi-million-dollar, quote, communications intercept system, end quote, designed to monitor Mexican cell phone traffic. Mexico's president says the cooperative effort is for the most part devoted to his country's war on drugs, but the implication is that any intelligence gathered as part of the system will be made freely available to U.S. national security authorities as well.
You've been listening to Media Minutes, a joint production of the Illinois Initiative for Media Policy Research at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign and Free Press, a national nonpartisan organization dedicated to media democracy. For more information, visit our website at freepress.net.
The views expressed on this program are those of the host and the participants.
Okie dokie, welcome back to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, coming to you live today in WILL AM 580 from truly beautiful Urbana, Illinois, this spectacular summer afternoon. Today we have a wonderful guest, as I mentioned at the top of the hour, but before we go to our guest, I want to let everyone know that the episode of Media Minutes you just listened to was the last episode that will be produced and presented by Kimberly Cronick and John Anderson, who've been doing it together for the last 3 years. John's been the lead executive producer of the show, and he has done a spectacular job. I think you'll all agree the show is now listened to, I think, on 40 or 50 radio stations around the country. It's really filled a huge niche. But John Anderson is a graduate student, and he needs to go on and start doing some teaching. He wants to do it, so he needs to have his time back, his life back, to work on that. Kimberly Cronick, as I think many of you know, is active here at WILL, so she has her plate full as well. We've got two new people I think you'll enjoy starting next week doing Media Minutes, and I'm glad we're going to be able to continue the program. But Kimberly and John Anderson are going to be missed very much, Kim Cronick and John Anderson. So thank you, Kimberly and John, for the great work you've done the last 3 years. Today's guest, as I mentioned at the top of the hour, is someone who's been on the show many times before, one of the leading critical journalists of the last two decades, has written numerous books on media and politics. His latest book, which came out, and we had him on to talk about it, War Made Easy, came out last year. And now there is a new documentary coming out based on the book, but with lots of new material, under the same name, War Made Easy, with the subtitle of How Presidents and Pundits Keep Spinning Us to Death. And Norman Solomon, the author of the book, is a lead figure in the movie, the dominant on-screen figure. So it is our pleasure here at Media Matters to welcome Norman to WILL. Norman?
Hi, Bob.
Thank you so much for taking time off of your Sunday to join us here in the heartland.
Hey, my pleasure.
Well, first of all, just for those listeners who have not read the book or didn't hear the show when you were on last year discussing it, quickly, if you wouldn't mind, give sort of a synopsis of what the argument was in War Made Easy.
Well, the book really pulls a thread from the past 50 years, beginning with the early 1960s, of one war after another, one episode of the U.S. news media in tandem with presidents and others in high positions in Washington, scamming the public, to be blunt about it, conveying through agenda setting and then cheerleading for a war, and then, in the case of particularly Vietnam and the current war in Iraq, insisting that the war must go on, that withdrawal would be precipitous, that you can't, to coin a phrase, cut and run. And the book also, I think, under the weight of historical evidence and now the film, really make a very strong argument that we've had this tendency falsely to believe or at least be told that these are anomalies when we are flagrantly lied to, that the Vietnam War was an aberration, now that the experience with WMDs and other deceptions about the invasion and now occupation of Iraq, somehow that is just some sort of strange blip on the historical screen. And what the evidence, I think, makes clear along with the analysis is that there's a pattern here. It's intrinsic to what we could call the warfare state and the relationships between the U.S. government and major media.
You know, we're going to talk about the film and the arguments in the book and draw on some of the history during the course of the program, Norman Solomon. But before we get to that, I do want to just talk about what has happened since you wrote the book in terms of press coverage of the Iraq War and U.S. foreign policy, because I think there has been almost a general acceptance across the board among media scholars and media critics, and even many politicians, that the press coverage of the buildup to the invasion of Iraq and the immediate occupation was deplorable, that the press did a lousy job. There are very few people who defend the press now for its conduct in 2002 and 2003. And even some of the major news media have issued mea culpas, albeit somewhat haltingly. Has this been reflected, do you think, in a serious improvement in the press coverage of the Iraq War and other U.S. foreign policy military operations?
I think the improvement has been in defogging the rearview mirror, but not in the windshield of looking at real time. Another way to say it is that, yes, now in 2007, we're getting much improved coverage of 2002 and what happened during that year and the first months of 2003. What we're not getting is real-time coverage that departs from the paradigm of over-reliance on official sources. And now the skeptics in Washington along Pennsylvania Avenue, they've gotten a wider array of coverage. You've got Democrats who are critical. They're getting a lot of airtime and ink. But I think we could critique even that rearview mirror I referred to. For instance, it's almost a truism in news media that we all thought there were weapons of mass destruction. And this kind of gives an out to the media and political establishment. We're all fooled together. The semi-mea culpa that came from Bill Keller in the New York Times belatedly over their false WMD reporting on Iraq, they said, well, we at the Times fell for the same false information that the Bush administration did. Well, I don't think the Times fell for it. They jumped for it and still haven't come clean on what were the dynamics of over-closeness between their editorial process and the propaganda process of the government that caused this to happen in the first place. We know, listeners to this program know, those who watched Phil Donahue before he was canceled just before the war on MSNBC, those who listened to people like Scott Ritter, the former UNSCON UN weapons inspector, we know it's a lie to say that we all thought there were WMDs in Iraq before the war began. So I think that's one problem. You look at real-time coverage now, though, and there's a ferocious air war going on in Anbar province and elsewhere in Iraq, very little coverage in the U.S. news media, and the failures of our coverage now may not come back to haunt those in Washington, but they are exacerbating the slaughter coming from high-tech U.S. weaponry in Iraq.
Is it just me, Norman Solomon, or does it seem like there's actually less coverage of the Iraq War in the news media today, especially the broadcast media, than there was 2 or 3 years ago?
I think there's a shift to the focus on Washington, that's where the action is, the political reporting. I didn't think I saw John Burns with the longtime Baghdad chief for the Times co-bylined with reporting from Washington lately. And I think that reflects an idea that what really matters, what's really important about this war is what's going on in Washington and how it affects the United States. And at the same time, that's a big problem with the failure of the news media to peel away the abstractions and look in human terms about what's happening to people in Iraq. We get coverage of what happens to Americans, really less what happens to Iraqis. And one analogy I would draw, in 1969, and the memo is quoted in the book, Av Weston, an ABC network news supervisor, sent a telex, which was what was used in those days, to Saigon and said, we need to change the tone of our network coverage of what's going on in Vietnam to focus more on the theme of the troops are coming home. And even though tremendous bombing, actually the bombing levels increased in Vietnam between 1969 and 1972, the U.S. networks and media in general were less interested in what was happening on the ground and from the air in Vietnam, and the story followed the Americans back home. And frankly, we may be seeing more and more of that vis-a-vis Iraq in the next couple of years.
Okay, our guest today on Media Matters is Norman Solomon, who is the author of the book War Made Easy. You've been listening to Norman. We're about to be joined on the line with Norman by Loretta Alper, who is the producer of the film War Made Easy. She'll be calling us from Massachusetts. Loretta Alper works with the Media Education Foundation out of Massachusetts, which has produced numerous films, including this one. So we'll get Loretta on the line with Norman, so we'll have both of them to discuss the film with us today here on Media Matters. If you'd like to call in with questions or comments for Norman Solomon, the number again here at WILL AM 580 is 333-9455, our toll-free number, 1-800-222-9455. So please do call in if you have questions or comments for Norman Solomon. Many of you also know that Norman Solomon is a political columnist who writes widely not only on U.S. politics and U.S. foreign policy, but on media coverage of a whole range of issues. So it's pretty much open season for those of you out there in the listening audience who have questions about media coverage, an opportunity to speak with really one of the great journalists on the subject working in the United States today. Before we go back to the phone lines and introduce Loretta, let me just say one quick thing. Next week, our guest here on Media Matters is going to be Ben Mansky, who is the executive director of a new organization called Liberty Tree. Ben Mansky has been very active in movements to link up various democracy movements, media reform, campaign finance reform, electoral reform. And I think you're all going to be really interested to hear about the organization he's founded and the work that's been going on, bringing all these disparate media reform movements or democracy reform movements together. So let's welcome Loretta Alper. Loretta, are you there?
Hello, Bob.
Thank you very much for joining Norman and me today on Media Matters.
Pleasure.
And for just briefly to introduce you to our guests, you work for the Media Education Foundation out of Northampton, and you're the executive producer or director of the film. Would you talk a little bit about, you know, why you decided to do this movie and what it took to get it done?
Yeah, sure. Immediately after we read the book, we thought it would be a perfect fit for what we do at the Media Education Foundation, which is look at social issues and political issues through a media lens, a critical analysis of the way issues are represented in the media. And, the will was there immediately to want to do this project. And, of course, Norman's book is just such a richly detailed historical analysis of the propaganda spin from Vietnam onward. But it did pose a lot of challenges to be able to get the footage to illustrate Norman's arguments. So it took longer than we thought it would take because of the research involved, but it's just an incredible experience sifting through this material and bringing it back into focus. And, it's a great project for MEF to be able to sort of critically examine the way wars have been spun and the media's role in that.
Now, how do you expect, Loretta Alper, for the film to be distributed? How will people be seeing this?
Well, Media Education Foundation, MEF, we distribute our own films that we produce, but those mainly go into classrooms, and we hope that this film will have a long life in the classroom. But because of the subject matter and because of its relevance to the current war, we decided on a different strategy to promote the film and to distribute it and to get it out into the hands of people and in front of people. And so with IPA and with Norman, with the Institute for Public Accuracy and with Norman and some other people who have helped along the way, we are using a strategy that Robert Greenwald sort of pioneered with his Brave New Theaters, where people can post a film on that website and you can sign up to host a screening and people can go to that website to find out where screenings are being held around the country. So that's one model we're using. We're just trying to do some screenings on our own, some theatrical screenings. That's a challenge because of the dearth of independent theaters that exist around the country and the way in which the kind of commercial theatrical system is closed to documentaries. Even Michael Moore is he's not at the Cineplex. He may be, but, we don't necessarily have any illusions about being at the Cineplex. But, theatrical distribution and this model of house parties and community screenings is really, really working well. And if people go to warmadeeasythemovie.org, they can get info and they'll be taken to the site where they can sign up to host a screening. And so those are going on all over the country right now.
Loretta, what was that website again?
It's warmadeeasythemovie.org.
Warmadeeasythemovie.org.
Yeah, and it's... In addition to just sort of, your typical kind of movie site with synopsis and, all that information about the film itself, there's a press page where people can go if the, particularly if you're hosting your own event, this is really one of the actions we're trying to encourage is for people to not only, have these screenings, but to get the word out about them and to publicize them and to, get to spread the message through the media. So there's an electronic press kit there. There are audio files that you can direct your local radio station to so that they can, play the film on the air. There's just all kinds of resources for people to, to sort of do an end run around the mainstream theatrical distribution system and host our own screenings and get the word out and get the word out to the local press that these screenings are happening.
Our guest today here on Media Matters, Loretta Alper, who you just heard from the Media Education Foundation, who is responsible for the film War Made Easy, which is based on Norman Solomon's book, and Norman's a prominent figure in the film. Norman Solomon also joining us on the phones. You've been listening to him earlier in the program from California. The film War Made Easy will be showing right here in Champaign-Urbana come August 1st at 7 p.m. at the Community United Church, 6th Street in Champaign. So this August 1st, 7 p.m., Community United Church, 6th Street in Champaign, you can have a chance to see War Made Easy. The number here at Media Matters, if you'd like to speak with Norman or Loretta, 333-9455. The toll-free number, 1-800-222-9455. Let's go to the phone lines right now. Line 1, Urbana, you're on the air with Norman and Loretta.
Hello, I think a byline should be, "And war made self-sustaining." I would like to cite two examples. One, in Afghanistan, when we plow up the farmer's fields and do not give him a meaningful substitute, we create an enemy, because if he can't survive, what is he going to do but join the other side? In some cases, we've given them coffee, which gives them half the profit or less, and twice the farmer-intensive work. Also, the second example is Venezuela. Chavez has recently ordered a military equipment from Russia, and I believe part of the reason is the spraying of herbicides, which contaminates the groundwater, which in some cases has blown over to legitimate crops. So thank you for your time. I'll hang up and listen.
Well, thank you very much, caller. And if I can just sort of rephrase those questions, Norman, for you. First of all, in sort of conventional wisdom for the last few years, in the U.S. news media and sort of official political debates, legitimate debates, the argument has gone, even among critics of the Iraq war, that the Afghanistan war was the good one. That's where we should have been fighting. And Iraq is the bad one. That's where we shouldn't have been fighting. And the Afghanistan war is entirely justified. We should be in there taking care of business. Do you think that – I don't know if you agree with that framing, but do you think that framing is accurate, what I see? And if so, is that accurate to the real-world situation?
Well, it's certainly been an effective framework that coverage has moved through in the news media and to some significant extent accepted by people who consider themselves anti-war. I think often of something that W.H. Auden wrote in 1939 in his poem of that name. He said, "Those to whom evil is done do evil in return." The notion that the United States can drop large quantities of explosives and kill civilians in the process whose country really, other than a regime in Kabul, had nothing to do with what happened on 9/11, is self-serving at best, part of American exceptionalism or the delusions thereof. The reality is, and we mentioned this in the film, that by the end of 2001, by any count, more civilians had been killed in Afghanistan by the U.S. government than the number of equally innocent civilians who died during the horrific events of 9/11 in the World Trade Center. So I think this is largely unexplored in the news media, the options that the U.S. had to this iron fist approach. And when the caller referred to plowing up the fields in Afghanistan, I immediately thought of the cluster bombs there. This is a topic that U.S. news media just haven't dealt with, the gratuitous use of cluster munitions that have been condemned by Amnesty International and Human Rights Watch as among the most horrific weapons on the planet, not only in Afghanistan, but since then in Iraq, in Yugoslavia in 1999, weapons that look like toys and are picked up as such by children months and many years later. And this is part of the huge hole in U.S. media coverage.
Well, let's talk, if we can, about these cluster bombs. What are? I mean, I hate to plead ignorance here, but what exactly are cluster bombs?
Well, they are weapons that are dropped. They can either be dropped from the air or used as munitions by the Army. They hold thousands of bomblets that move horizontally at high rates of speed and shred human bodies, what the, in the terrible parlance of the war industry, soft targets. They have some military uses, but they are extremely horrific, and I would say, to put it mildly, the use is gratuitous. And they also have a high dud rate, which is to say that many years later, let me put it this way, in Laos, where the U.S. used these weapons, you still have hundreds of people a year who are injured or killed, many of them, as I say, children, for picking these up. Israel has scattered huge quantities of these in Lebanon from its attack on that country last summer, with the taxpayers of the U.S. government footing the bill. And this just seems to be a no-go zone. Most European papers have done a far better job of covering this than media outlets in the United States.
One other point that the caller raised, Norman Solomon, was Venezuela. And I would be interested to know, based on your research and your observations, how you think the coverage of Venezuela fits into your model of war made easy, understanding that Venezuela, unlike Iraq, has a democratically elected government, and how that, what sort of problems that presents for the press coverage.
Well, the Venezuelan government is not susceptible, to put it mildly, to manipulation or pressure from Washington. So almost automatically, therefore, since it's held in disfavor along Pennsylvania Avenue, it's widely condemned in U.S. media. Whatever flaws in the democratic process there, it's a much more democratic country than many that the United States government embraces as paragons of democratic virtue in various parts of the country, the qualification for that description being that there's alignment with U.S. foreign policy goals. I think that the media coverage of Venezuela, which after all is driven out of the White House and the State Department, as usual, is part of agenda setting for war. And we have a media spin cycle for war that's got these different facets. You could say we are now in the you can't leave, you can't cut and run, can't withdraw phase of spin cycle vis-a-vis Iraq. We are in the agenda setting for war vis-a-vis Iran. And frankly, if the resources of the U.S. military and, so to speak, the American empire weren't so stretched thin right now, I think the propaganda campaign against Venezuela would properly be called agenda setting for war. It's just, even when you're the Pentagon and the White House, there are limits to your military capabilities.
Our guest, Norman Solomon, who you've just been listening to, author of the book War Made Easy, and now one of the key figures in the documentary based upon the book called War Made Easy as well. We're also joined on the phone by Loretta Alper, who is the executive producer of the film, who works for the Media Education Foundation out of Massachusetts, which is responsible for the film. Before we go back to the phone lines, Loretta, I'd like to ask you, what has the response been to the movie so far?
I'm very happy to say that it's been overwhelmingly positive, and that's, you know, I think it's just a sign of how hungry people are for information and for truth at this point in what Norman refers to the spin cycle of this war. And so, yeah, the response has been really, really positive. And, you know, I could refer to things that people have told me about what really resonates with them. And just to go back to something Norman was talking about, which is the civilian casualties. We have a statistic in the film that talks about the rise of civilian casualties, even in this era of so-called smart weapons and high-tech weaponry. Civilian casualties are on the rise, and that's been the case in Afghanistan too. As we see this kind of limited troop drawdown in Afghanistan and replacement by NATO forces or limited American withdrawal, civilian casualties have increased through the use of cluster bombs and other kinds of bombing. As boots on the ground leave, we increase the air war, and that's what's been happening in Afghanistan. And talking about civilian casualties, which is such a rarity in the U.S. press, that's one of the things that resonates especially powerfully with audiences, I think.
Our guests, Norman Solomon and Loretta Alper, co-makers, I guess to put it, of the new film War Made Easy. There will be a showing of this film here in Champaign-Urbana come August 1st, 7 p.m. at the Community United Church on 6th Street in Champaign. So put that down on your calendars if this interests you. Our telephone number here at Media Matters is 333-9455. Our toll-free number, 1-800-222-9455. Let's go back to the phone lines right now. Line 1, Champaign County, you're on the air with Norman Solomon and Loretta Alper.
Good afternoon, all. Two salients have come up just in the last couple of minutes. In a documentary circulation, I noted that Sicko only opened on 241 screens, though until it was released, it was actually supposed to go out on 1,000. I've never heard a good explanation on why that is. I haven't really searched too hard on Michael Moore's site, but I assume that that's part of the symptom. On that latter point, the kind of off-topic with Chavez, is it's interesting to note that Gates was going to go down to Latin America for a week and had to cancel it because of the problem. It's a graphic illustration of the fact that Iraq has stopped this administration from having an Andean gambit, I guess one might call it. As a way of talking about what you've done in the film, I would like for you to contrast it with the work of Moyers on his two-hour special that he kicked off his journal with. I saw some very interesting things in that. I was unsettled by the presence of Walter Pincus, who was formerly an asset of the CIA, being interviewed as a grand eminence on the whole condition of Washington at this time. He's critical, but a lot of people are critical from all different directions. And I'm just wondering what you feel you're contributing to the debate that in some ways goes beyond or supplements what that work included. And perhaps at the end we'll hear something about the fact that the 15th of July is important for the circulation of small magazines, and also the internet radio deadlines are happening. And I know that's close, and maybe people will just go to freepress.net and look for it there. But sorry to be all over the place. I'll hang up and listen. Thank you.
Thank you very much, caller. Norman, Loretta, you want to tee off on that?
Well, by way of disclaimer, I was interviewed in the Bill Moyers documentary, Buying the War. I think he did a really good job of talking about and showing through footage and interviews how the press was so craven and opportunistic and really betrayed their responsibilities in terms of informing the public before war took place. The War Made Easy film, I think, is more historical in that we go back 50 years to the Gulf of Tonkin events in 1964, or non-events, and trace a pattern that goes from Walter Cronkite to Bill O'Reilly, and frankly, stylistic differences aside, not that much difference in the roles that they played in building and supporting a war and public acceptance or enthusiasm for war. It's really stunning to see in the footage in War Made Easy some of the great icons of journalism in decades past, indicted not by condemnation from others, but by footage of themselves. For instance, Walter Cronkite in Vietnam in 1965, avidly expressing enthusiasm to a top military U.S. official about the bombing that he had just, in a sense, participated in going up in the cockpit over Vietnam. And I think overall, and Loretta, I don't know what you might add to this, but in a sense, War Made Easy is a historical sweep that uses footage and analysis to show that what we're going through now with Iraq is not an anomaly at all, but part of a very deep pattern of the U.S. warfare state.
Well, Loretta, before you jump on that, if you want to add something, let me just follow up with you, Norman, on the Vietnam situation, because, you know, I think in the sort of common sense parlance of U.S. political culture and how media understand themselves, Vietnam was a golden age of journalism coverage where the media went after the government and exposed lies and really led the public to an oppositional stance. It was not seen as being a supportive force of the military and the U.S. government necessarily. Certainly the political right, the Oliver North of the world, regard the media in the 1960s, early 1970s as being, you know, a hostile enemy force.
Yeah, that's one of the great mythologies. And yet, as we point out in the film, in early 1968, the Boston Globe did a survey of 39 major U.S. newspapers and could not find a single one that at that point had editorialized for U.S. withdrawal of troops from Vietnam. And this was after massive protests involving hundreds of thousands of people at a time in this country to withdraw the troops. I drew heavily on the work of Daniel Hallin, the professor who wrote The Uncensored War, and he went through, in turn, hundreds of hours of broadcast footage from the Vietnam War, the major networks, and of course, those were the only networks back then. And the reality of the coverage is so different than the mythology. There's no golden age to look back at. There's been changes in style, but great continuity and boosterism for war from the major outlets.
Loretta, did you want to add anything to that?
Agreed, certainly. And I think especially in the build-up to a war, the parallels are especially striking because you see how journalists, when a war is being sold by the government, journalists interpret their role as being supportive of the war and supportive of the objectives of the war rather than doing their jobs, which is to verify facts and check information and go behind the official story. And that is, you know, that holds true for all of the wars that we looked at.
I noticed, couldn't help but notice, I was watching the film in the last few days, that your on-air voice, your what do you call that person?
The narrator.
God, thank you. Yeah, that's why you're the producer. The narrator was Sean Penn, the Oscar-winning actor, known for his strong political convictions. And I was wondering, how did that relationship come about? Because he's clearly a person in high demand.
Well, I met him from going to Baghdad with him in December of 2002, as it turned out, 3 months before the invasion of Iraq. And when he heard about the film and we asked if he would narrate, he was very gracious and eager, really, to donate his voice and his reputation to help make the film happen.
Okay, our guest again, Norman Solomon, who just heard, Loretta Alper, you heard just before him, co-makers of the new film War Made Easy, which has just come out. We'll be showing August 1st right here in Champaign, as mentioned before. We have lines that are open at 333-9455 or our toll-free number 1-800-222-9455. Let's go to the phone lines right now. Line 4, Farina, thank you for your patience. You're on the air with Norman Solomon and Loretta Alper.
Hi. Interesting topic. I wondered how a person could just buy the film, you know, for their home use, if it's going to be available, and maybe how much. Also, I wonder if Richard Lugar and his compatriot there in the Senate are going to just hint about a possible impeachment, like about 5 years from now. And it was real nice to see John Nichols on the Moyers Journal last night. And that's all I have to comment about. Thanks.
Well, there is a very easy way to get the DVD, and this is the main distribution system. If you go to the website, you can get hold of it for $20 and then either show it privately in your own home or do what a lot of people are doing, which is to organize the community showings, as we said. They're scheduled now in libraries, churches, synagogues, mosques, and all the rest of public venues. And we have 50 that we know of just in the next few weeks around the country. So I'd recommend going to the website, and as I say, you can get hold of the DVD. It's warmadeeasythemovie.org. And something I think we haven't mentioned yet is that the full transcript of the film is posted with no charge, and I find that very useful because it's really so well documented, and a lot of statements are so mind-blowing, it's great to have the citations.
Yeah, the one point that the caller made, too, in reference to the Moyers program on Friday night where John Nichols appeared to talk about the question of impeachment, clearly what you describe in this book, Norman, is a in many cases violations of international treaties, international law, which are by definition impeachable offenses in the U.S. Constitution. But if I follow your argument correctly, not just the current president, but there's a list of presidents who deserve impeachment based on that criteria.
Well, that would include, and this is to the consternation of some who have seen the film, that would include Bill Clinton, who in 1999 was unable to get through the Congress what is required as the bombing of Yugoslavia continued, and that was under the War Powers Act, approval after the bombing had continued for 60 days of the continuation of really what were major hostilities. And if you were in Belgrade and bombs were falling in your neighborhood, they certainly would fall under that category. They got a tie vote. They didn't get a majority vote. So rather than accede to or respect the War Powers Act, Bill Clinton just ignored it, and the U.S. news media virtually left that uncovered.
Our guests today, Norman Solomon, Loretta Alper, co-producers, co-makers of the brand new film War Made Easy. It will be showing right here in Champaign on August 1st at 7 p.m. at the Community United Church on 6th Street in Champaign. So make sure you get there if this interests you. I've seen the film. It's well worth your seeing. I think the way it's been described as loaded with evidence and factual basis for a fairly complex argument, not just a usual Iraq war argument about what's going on here, but linking it to patterns going back to the Vietnam War and ever since, and sort of understanding the dilemmas we're facing. One of the things that I think immediately jumps out, and you've sort of alluded to it briefly, Norman Solomon, is why does the press keep this up? Why not, you know, after time again, in which the press, in retrospect, says, gee whiz, we laid an egg in Vietnam. We laid an egg in the invasion in Iraq in 2003. We had problems in the Central America in the 80s and with the invasion of Panama. At what point, you know, journalism schools and people say, okay, let's get it right next time. What's preventing that from happening?
Well, as Mark Twain said, it's easy to quit smoking. I've done it hundreds of times. There are so many rewards for going along to get along. There are so many ways in which there are deterrents for going too far out on a limb. I think it's accurate to say that journalists want to be a little bit ahead of the curve, but not too far out on a limb. It's not a career enhancer to be far away from the way that the herd is running. And there are enormous pressures of conformity, of not being conspicuous in a way that will bring down the wrath of the Pentagon when a war is going high, wrath from the White House, and from advertisers or irate, organized right-wing viewers who can say that insufficient patriotism is involved. If you're a journalist, doesn't matter where you are, including the PBS NewsHour, which doesn't turn up well at all in terms of content analysis, you don't want any substantial part of the power structure, or for that matter, viewers and listeners organizing, to claim that you are not patriotic and you are undermining the troops.
Let's go back to the phone lines right now. Line 2, Spring Bay, you're on the air with Norman Solomon and Loretta Alper.
Thank you. Well, I'm kind of like a broken record. I'm always talking about Iraq and oil. And I'm just confused why the press hasn't really done it. What I feel is a better job analyzing the root causes and concerns of this war. For example, February 28th, Asia Times Online had an article that the headline was U.S. Oil Grab, a Done Deal, and they went into pretty good detail on what this Iraqi oil sharing revenue law is. And they were saying that this could be essentially the end of OPEC. And then we had the bombing in the parliament several months later, and it turns out they were discussing that oil revenue sharing bill. And then the Iraqi government didn't want to meet all summer. And I keep thinking, well, it's because they don't want to talk about this oil sharing revenue bill. So, to your knowledge, has the New York Times or any of the major media outlets done a thorough exploration of what is in this bill and what the things would be for some of the major American oil companies? And I'll hang up and listen to your comments on the radio. Thank you.
Thank you very much, caller. Norman?
Well, there's been very little coverage in what we call the mainstream news, the A section of a place like the New York Times or Washington Post, somewhat more factual because they're serving investors. Coverage from places like the Wall Street Journal I think it's notable that we get very little attention to the fact that the notorious Dick Cheney Energy Task Force in early 2001 met in secret, and we know this only because of unanticipated release through court order through the Freedom of Information Act. They laid out on the table detailed maps of Iraq showing location of known oil reserves, the grade, the depth, the difficulty of retrieval, problems and potential for transport out of that region. Why would the Energy Task Force of the U.S. government under the Vice President be so meticulously mapping and analyzing the oil locations in Iraq if it was of no moment? I think there's been very little media focus on this. It's just maybe too threatening to look at the evidence of how much U.S. military actions are tied to essentially what are energy wars that are underway.
Just to add to that briefly, too, I would say that right now when we're getting the Bush had to give the report on the benchmarks that are have failed to yet to be met, you've heard a very brief mention of what the caller referred to, which is the, you know, the oil revenue sharing. And that's about as in-depth as the coverage of it has gone. There's really been virtually no mainstream news coverage of what this very difficult and contentious issue is and why it hasn't been dealt with and who's pushing for it and who's going to get what piece of the pie. And, you know, that's another area, I think, of trying to manage. It's connected to the rationales for war and why we're hearing so little about it.
Norman and Loretta, I'd like to ask each of you, where do you get your information on U.S. foreign policy in general and what the U.S. is doing around the world in general, and specifically with regard to Iraq and Venezuela and Iran? What reporters do you rely on? What websites, what media do you go to sort of make heads or tails of what's going on if, in fact, the mainstream U.S. news media are so deficient?
I think, you know, people always ask this of me and of MEF films in general is, you know, if the mainstream news is so deficient, you know, how do we stay informed? And, you know, I think the best answer that I can give people is that it's just you really need a variety of sources. And so, you know, in the Internet age, that means there's some terrific Internet news services that provide compendiums of the best news out there, and international sources and international newspapers. And, you know, that's what I tell people, you know, my family and friends and people who say, well, you know, what can we do about this and how can we stay better informed? It's so important to have a variety of news sources.
I certainly think that's very true. You know, a real ecology of media sourcing. And also reading, say, a place like the New York Times, I think of something that the great media critic Gina Lollobrigida said. She said, I don't tell lies because it's so difficult to keep track of them. And those who run U.S. foreign policy and who are part of the punditocracy largely behind it, they have that problem. The New York Times has a lot of information, and if you contrast and compare and read logically and don't fall down the Orwellian memory hole of expunging certain information when arguments are being considered, you can learn a heck of a lot in the New York Times if you have that sort of memory involved. I'm very fond of The Independent in London, The Guardian out of London. Often you can access a lot of those articles through commondreams.org, truthout.org, as someone who's been an associate of FAIR for a long time, fair.org, and, you know, multiplicity of other sources, including alternate.org. But ultimately, there's no gospel. We need to think critically and find a lot of sources in the process.
We have another caller. I want to get back to Norman Solomon and Loretta Alper. But first, I'd like each of you, if you would just briefly, to talk a little bit about your home organization. Norman, you are the executive director for IPA, Institute for Public Accuracy, and I'm on that board. I want everyone to know that, so I have a connection there. And Loretta, you, of course, are with the Media Education Foundation. Why don't you just a little bit about each of those organizations, since they're both really sort of central to your own work and really underlie this film. Norman, why don't you go first?
Well, the Institute for Public Accuracy really bears on the last question, because we put out about 200 news releases a year, and we go often to primary sources and eyewitnesses. For instance, the massacre in Pakistan just a couple of days ago, we had eyewitnesses there talking about the political reaction there in Pakistan. And on the oil law, we've had probably a dozen news releases in the last 6 or 8 months bearing on the oil manipulation. People can go to the web at accuracy.org and see what we're up to there. All of our news releases are archived in perpetuity.
And the idea is this is information that goes to working journalists, so you're providing alternative sources for them to work with?
Yeah, it's available to everyone, but our special target, so to speak, is journalists. About 9,000 of them get each release. And the search engine at accuracy.org is pretty good at this point, so people can go back and, again, contrast and compare, get information that is often not seeing the light of day in U.S. mass media.
Okay, Loretto, how about the Media Education Foundation?
Media Education Foundation is an independent nonprofit film production and distribution organization founded by our executive director, Sut Jolly, who's a professor at the University of Massachusetts, who made our first film, Dreamworld, way back when and in the 80s, and was served a cease and desist notice by MTV. The film looks at images of sexuality and women in music video, and he was using it in his classroom, and he was distributing it around to other professors who were using it in their classrooms. And he was given a cease and desist order by MTV and realized that he had a kind of precedent-making case on his hands here with that film. And he did not back down, and MTV eventually did back down, and that was the genesis of the Media Education Foundation, which is that we operate under the Fair Use Clause of the Copyright Law, which enables us to use copyrighted material in for educational purposes, for purposes of recontextualizing and criticizing, and of course, corporate media doesn't like that because, and that was one of the challenges in making War Made Easy, is that, you know, a lot of this footage that we needed for the film is so off limits. It's either expensive or not available, and that's what we do with the Media Education Foundation, is take a look at the way in which issues are framed, either through the news, through advertising, through popular culture, and, media ownership issues, certainly drawing on a lot of your work, Bob, in the way in which media ownership affects the coverage and the way issues are represented. And we've been around for 16 years, and we have about 50 films in our catalog. And as I mentioned earlier, most of them are viewed in an educational context, and that is our primary target audience. But on occasion, we do films that really just get out into the wider world because they're relevant to a current topic, and that's the case with War Made Easy. And in reference to the caller who mentioned oil, we do have a film coming out this fall called Blood and Oil. It's based on Michael Clare's book, and it looks at how energy policy has shaped foreign policy, and that's a great overview going back to FDR and his meeting with King Saud on the USS Lincoln. So that film will be out looking at how oil has shaped the pursuit of oil and the control of oil.
And the website, Loretta, for people who want to learn more about MEF?
Yeah, it's mediaed.org.
Mediaed.org.
That's the Media Education Foundation's website, and then the War Made Easy website to learn more about our movie is WarMadeEasyTheMovie.org.
We have one more phone caller who's been waiting patiently from San Francisco, no less, to speak with Norman Solomon and Loretta Alper. Let's go to the phones again. San Francisco, line one, you're on the air.
As with most subjects, I believe Norman Solomon hit the nail on the head earlier in the program by saying that one of the big problems with the media is that many journalists are unwilling to go out on a limb. One group that's gone out on a limb consistently over the years has been some students at Sonoma State at the Project Censored program there, and I was really rather shocked to read yesterday from the Illinois Times that both Norman Solomon and Robert Jensen have resigned as judges at Project Censored over the issue of 9/11. And I mentioned this too. To me, I've been looking into this, and I don't know that Stephen Jones' theories are the correct ones. In fact, I favor Jim Fetzer's investigations at his particular website, which is 911scholars.org, but I wonder if Norman Solomon could explain his reason, if this is so, why he would resign from that important judgeship.
Sure,
and
be glad.
Anyway, thank you.
Yeah. Be glad to. I resigned.
Maybe Norman, just give a little bit of context, because I suspect a lot of our listeners are unfamiliar with what the caller is talking about.
Yeah, I've been a judge with Project Censored for many years. I think it's a very good organization and good effort. There's an annual conference that gives awards for stories, best censored stories. And the most recent one, there was number 18 by Stephen Jones, some theories about what happened with the World Trade Center. He was chosen to give the keynote, and I urged that there be an actual debate rather than giving the number 18 story author the solo to give a point of view that is widely disputed by progressives and others. And there was no debate allowed at all. There was no willingness to have any other view on the program, but only one view. So,
and
I
what
felt,
was this viewpoint? If I mean, this is a.
Oh yeah, he said that there was a controlled explosion, that it was basically a conspiracy, and that there was an inside job
on 9/11.
Government on 9/11.
Okay.
And I think that there ought to be a debate on this. I don't think that Project Censored should be championing that point of view without having a debate. Certainly not to give the keynote speech with no other viewpoints allowed at their annual awards conference. So, you know, I actually sent a letter to the judges and resigned, and I didn't want to slam the door as I left. There's been a belated story in the Illinois Times which dealt with none of this at all. I wasn't even interviewed, although when I was emailed, I was asked, and I said I'd be glad to. So it's kind of unfortunate. It's not a well-done story, not accurate, but, you know, and so it goes.
All right. Well, our guest today, Norman Solomon, you just heard, Loretta Alper, who you've been listening to from the Media Education Foundation. We've only got about a minute or minute and a half left in the show. Norman, one question I've been wanting to ask you is, you know, you've been a media critic now, a columnist and an author for, I dare say, approaching two decades. You know, what is your sense in terms of the quality of the U.S. news media today compared to 1987 or 1990? Is there a noticeable difference? Is it about the same? Has it gotten better? What trends have you seen?
I think the styles have changed. The advent of cable television being so important, if not in numbers, at least in driving coverage, has shifted stylistically. But I think that in many ways it's a bit worse. The punditry, the ability and willingness to put people like Bill O'Reilly on, have bombast driving so much of the coverage, is unfortunate. But I don't see any good old days to use as a counterpoint. This has been systemic. It's been endemic. It's been ongoing. You know, a quick example is just the ahistorical coverage. On Thursday, George W. Bush said, I'm quoting here, "I don't think Congress ought to be running the war," unquote. And this is a classic thing, I might say. In the film, Wayne Morse, the great senator during the Vietnam War, challenged that idea, which you need to look at the U.S. Constitution. And I would just sum up by saying the U.S. news media are so contemptuous, on the whole, of what's really in the Constitution, that the actual responsibilities and power of the legislative branch to shape and make basic decisions on war and peace, we rarely even get a factual recounting of the reality of our own Constitution.
I hear the band tuning up in the background, which usually means they want to clear me out of the studio to let Tavis Smiley or someone else get in here for the next hour. I want to thank you, Norman Solomon, for joining me today from California to talk about the new film War Made Easy. And I want to thank you, too, Loretta Alper from Massachusetts, for talking about the film War Made Easy. It's been a pleasure having both of you on the air with me.
Thanks, Bob.
Thanks so much, Bob.
Yeah, I'm Bob McChesney. I want to thank Andrew Boyle, my wonderful producer, who put this show together. And again, a special thanks to Kimberly Cronick and to John Anderson from Media Minutes, who did their last of 3 years of episodes of Media Minutes today. We'll be back with a new team next week, and I'll be back then, too. Thank you all very much. Have a great week, listeners.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from Mike Weaver Ballroom Dance, private instruction for social or competitive dancing, weddings, or other special events, lessons for singles or couples, beginners or advanced of all ages. Information at 378-4601 or on your web, search at Mike Weaver Ballroom Dance.
This afternoon in Champaign-Urbana, mostly sunny with a high in the mid-80s and light north winds. Tonight, partly cloudy with a low in the lower 60s and light east winds. Tomorrow, mostly sunny with a high in the upper 80s and light south winds. Tomorrow night, mostly cloudy with a chance of showers and thunderstorms. The low in the upper 60s with light southwest winds. This is WILL Urbana, the listener-supported broadcast service of the University of Illinois. It's 2 p.m. The Tavis Smiley Show is next.
From PRI, Public Radio International in Los Angeles, I'm Tavis Smiley. He says everything he said 4 years ago about the war in Iraq, among other things, has come true. Today we'll talk with Congressman Dennis Kucinich about his latest political predictions and his bid for president.
People want to know if they have leaders who have the judgment and the vision and the maturity to be able to do the right thing in a moment of crisis. And I led the effort in telling the people of our country and our Congress, don't go to war. There's no proof. We have to be very careful about using that force against a country that did not attack us.
We'll also talk about the risks and benefits of private U.S. security contractors in conflict regions around the globe. We got a few tips for helping kids avoid the summer slide. Plus, R&B legend Eddie LaVert offers some life lessons on love and loss after the sudden tragic death of his son, Gerald LaVert. This hour, the Tavis Smiley Show from PRI, after the news.